and the geometry of the Hilbert space. And some information theoretic concepts. Like the so-called fidelity. And other quantities that are interesting in quantum physics. So this will be, so some of these concepts can also be translated into classical phase transitions, but others cannot, like what is the relationship between quantum phase transitions and Berry phases. And we saw also the connection between Berry phases and the geometry of the Hilbert space. So this is a very novel, modern way of looking at quantum phase transitions. Well, the whole topic of quantum phase transitions is quite new. But this is a very modern topic. And it's motivated by two reasons. So the first reason is that, so how do we know? We have a QPT, a quantum phase transition. Well, there are two ways. One is, let's say, more phenomenological. So this happens when we have some order parameter O, and this shows some singular behavior, like, for instance, the magnetization, or in other cases can have really a jump and so on and so forth in different phases. So in order to draw the phase diagram for a system by using the order parameter, which by the way is always supposed to thought to be local, one needs to know which is the relevant order parameter. So if I present you some model, you might not know. It's the interesting order parameter. Moreover, there are models in which there is not such a thing. There is no local order parameter. So, but we still want to spot quantum phase transitions and draw phase diagrams. So models in which there is no local order parameter are what I said, I called many times topologically ordered models that we'll be exploring in the second part of the course. So, well, the other criterion is that at least for continuous phase transitions, well, we can look at the second or higher derivative of the ground state energy with to respect some parameter lambda, where these parameters lambda enter the Hamiltonian. So the Hamiltonian is H of lambda. So just to be clear, in the case of the models that we studied, this could be the Ising coupling or the external magnetic field. So we look at this, and if we find some singularity in here, we know that we have a quantum phase transition. Okay, so this method here suggests that a quantum phase transition means something dramatic happening to the ground state. And we would like to know what is this something. So all this discussion is motivated by this. We want to understand what is this something dramatic. Then there is the second motivation, that every time you find some novel method, you always find some new usage for that, and we will see something like that. So we will be able to find some interesting results. Well, it's only that this fidelity, this baby faces, we have introduced new quantities. So, and if we relate them to the quantum phase transition, we know something more, because understanding means that we make relationships between facts. Okay, so there is another object, probably I will not be able to talk about it today, which is entanglement. So the other thing that we would like to do is to understand the relationship between quantum phase transitions and entanglement. And this is one of the most studied subjects in modern condensed matter theory. And very recently, it is also been studying in this new community that puts together string theorists and condensed matter theorists through the correspondence ADS, CFT, of which I don't have the time to talk about. But just know that string theorists and condensed matter theorists, and through this correspondence, are trying to understand some condensed matter systems that are supposed to be described by conformal field theory, and the main object that they compute is entanglement. Okay. So we start with our connection with the geometry of the Hilbert space. So what are these parameter lambda? So these parameter lambda are a set of parameters, lambda 1, lambda n. So this is in R to the n. So we can imagine this lambda to live in some patch of R to the n that can be or not to the whole R to the n, or it can be just some local patch. So lambda lives here. Well, and to every lambda, you associate some Hamiltonian, H of lambda. So, and this mapping is supposed to be smooth. So this means that we do not introduce any kind of non-analytic behavior by just this mapping. The Hamiltonian is a continuous, infinitely times differentiable operator with respect to lambda. But then we can diagonalize our Hamiltonian. So in particular, we can find the ground state. So for the sake of simplicity, imagine that we have a unique ground state. So that there is no real loss of generality in this. It just makes the treatment simpler. So we have some psi zero that depends on lambda through this mapping. Okay. So there is no, we don't know if this is smooth. In general, could be not smooth. So there is no guarantee that if some operator is smooth, all its eigenvectors are smooth. Okay. So where do these guys live? So these are ground states of this Hamiltonian. So we would like to think that they live in some Hilbert space. Well, this is a bit sloppy because, as you know, quantum states are normalized. They are rays in the Hilbert space. So they belong to some projective Hilbert space in which you normalize these vectors. And, okay. Now, the interesting thing is that this space is a metric space, so we can define a distance between quantum states that is called Fubini study distance. So it's a distance in here. So the states are normalized. And it's defined, so the distance between two states, phi and psi, is defined like the arc cosine of some quantity called fidelity between phi and psi. And this quantity called fidelity is simply the absolute value of the overlap between phi and psi. This is a very simple quantity. So what can happen to this quantity? So these two states could be completely indistinguishable. So this means that they could be the same state up to a phase. Well, in this case, the fidelity would be 1. Or they can be completely distinguishable. So you know that being completely distinguishable means that if you look at the distribution of probabilities of some, so imagine that we compute the statistics of the values that some operator can take in some quantum state, so then you will have a distribution of probability of some observable in phi, and then you could have another one in psi. Well, and you have some degree of distinguishability that is given, right, by how small is this overlap. So when two states are orthogonal, means that you can find two observables such that these distributions do not touch. And so you can, with probability one, discriminate in which of the two states you are. So, for instance, if you have the magnetic a system with a single spin, and you, so two, why you can distinguish two orthogonal states like spin up and spin down is because you measure the magnetization. In one case, you find plus one, in the other case, find minus one that are peaked around plus one and minus one because they are eigenstates, so you can distinguish them. So this has some operational meaning, this quantity. So when they're completely distinguishable, they're, as I said, they're orthogonal states and the fidelity is zero. In between, you have all the values between zero and one, and then you take the arc cosine and you define this distance. Okay. Now, so we would like to see if it's possible to associate a metric tensor to this distance. So the answer is yes. And so let me just write it. Q. Oh, let me use small q right now. Small q. So it must be something that takes two values, two vectors u and v, and associates some number. So the metric tensor associated to this distance is the scalar product between u and this operator, that is 1 minus psi psi v, where, so this is the metric tensor at the point psi, right? So what we are doing is that for every point in our Hilbert space, so a point is a state, we associate a metric tensor that is defined in this way. Okay, so this is a definition. And we would like to write the corresponding, so what happens when we instead consider an infinitesimal line element, ds squared in here. So when you have, we have the differential version of this. So and the expression for this is, so let me use capital Q. Q mean nu is this quantity. So it's the mu psi zero, the nu psi zero minus the mu psi zero times psi zero, the nu psi zero. Okay? And then our distance, let me call it ds tilde, would be simply the sum over mu nu q mu nu, the lambda mu, the lambda mu. So this is exactly what you do usually in differential geometry. So the only thing is that usually in differential geometry, you are used to have a Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian tensor, which means that these numbers are real positive numbers, but these are complex numbers. So this is the basic difference. So that's why this object is called quantum geometric tensor. Yeah.
Sorry. Can you just repeat the what the FS stands for? And D sub.
Sorry, I didn't understand.
Can you repeat what FS stands for and D sub FS?
Fubini study metric. So Fubini study is FS.
Okay.
That's it.
So these are just the guys who invented.
Fubim. F U B I M.
Sorry. Fubini.
Fubini. Okay. Thank you.
And the definition of Q mu nu.
This is a definition. Yeah.
Yeah. There is in the second line minus Q mu.
In the second line.
It's yes, the mu psi zero psi zero times psi zero the nu psi
times,
zero.
Okay.
Let me rewrite it. Okay. Since it's the fundamental object. Lambda mu is simply one of these vectors, one of these numbers. Right. So mu nu label these derivatives, right? So these indexes are labeling what is the mu is the over the lambda mu. Right? So mu takes values 1. And I'm just differentiating with respect to one of these parameters.
So we have metric in Rn, not in Hilbert space.
No. So the entries of this, so it's an n times n matrix, which entries are these quantities that are complex numbers.
Yeah, but I mean, what is the relation with the metric tensor? Because the metric tensor is a metric in the Hilbert space, and this one is a metric in all parameter space.
No, this is a metric in the Hilbert space. So we have this object here. So
but here we have d lambda, so it's in lambda space, or
okay. So yeah, so this is the metric pulled back to the parameter space, but so this metric acts, so the tangent space of this object is made by some complex vectors, so some complex vector space over our initial parameter space.
Okay, but for example, in the metric tensor, the entries U and V are labeled by a vector of parameters or are independent?
So these are labeled by lambda?
No. But in the metric, in the upper metric tensor,
yeah,
the U and V vectors in the Hilbert space, are they labeled? Is every vector labeled by a vector of parameters?
No, not necessarily. No, they're just vectors in the tangent Hilbert space. So what labels the parameters label the value of the metric tensor. Okay. So we would like to know what is the relationship between this quantum geometric tensor and this Fubini study distance, which is some real number. So they're not exactly the same thing. So the relationship is the following. So we look at the real path of Q mu nu. So this will give us a G mu nu that is a Riemannian tensor. And then we look at the imaginary path of Q mu nu, which we will call large F mu nu. And so to this real part, we can associate some line element ds squared without the tilde, that is g mu nu, the lambda mu, the lambda nu. And the relationship with the fidelity is that the fidelity between two states that are very close, so in order to be very close, we evaluate them at some value of the parameter lambda, and then we change the parameter a little bit. Okay, so these are the ground states of the Hamiltonian. We change a little bit the parameter, and so we have two states that are very close. So this thing can be approximated like 1 minus ds squared over 2. So my line element for the that is induced by this Riemannian metric tensor is measures the distance in terms of fidelity. So it's telling me how much our fidelity is decreasing. Okay, so this is the relationship between these two things. This imaginary part, well, then it will be just the imaginary part of the, so we have two terms there. So by normalization, you can easily show that the imaginary part of the second term is equal to 0. So we are only left with the imaginary part of the first term. So we have the imaginary part of the mu the psi 0, the nu psi 0. And, well, so this thing can be written like the mu psi 0, the nu psi 0, minus the nu psi 0, the mu psi 0. And if we define this quantity, A mu being psi, then nu psi, so the mu then this becomes the mu a nu minus the nu a mu. So it's what is called the two fold. And this is also what is called the adiabatic connection. Or, and this two form is called adiabatic curvature. So when you compute the Berry phases of a system, so you can show that you can compute this Berry phase by integrating these two forms. So there is some metric, some curvature actually, because it's a two-form that is induced on the Hilbert space by the adiabatic transport, induced by the adiabatic theorem. And I remind you that the adiabatic transport means that we move in the Hilbert space in a way that we stay always in the same ground state manifold, so we do not go to excited states. Yeah.
Why don't we take the last term in Q mu nu into account when we take the imaginary part?
Because you can show, so I'll leave it to you as an exercise, that it's identically, the imaginary part of that is identically zero. And the hint to do that is to use the normalization of states. So, meaning that the mu of psi psi is equal to zero.
Okay.
So, if you do a couple of lines, it's.
Well, it's just a subtlety, but shouldn't you have an imaginary unit somewhere there?
Oh, yeah, I am forgetting it. All right. Okay. Now there is, so these are the real part and the imaginary part. Now there is a very useful expression for Q mu nu, and finding this expression will be part of one of your homeworks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the following. So we would like to express our ground state, actually the variation of our ground state, in terms of, we can expand it in the eigenvectors of our Hamiltonian, right? Because that's a basis. So, but this is the variation that is induced to a very small change in the Hamiltonian. So pretty much working out this calculation is the same thing that you have learned to do in perturbation theory, only that because this is not a finite difference, but it's an infinitesimal difference, the first order perturbation theory becomes exact. So you don't find something like this, but you find an exact expression in terms of the variation of the perturbation of the Hamiltonian. But what is the perturbation of the Hamiltonian? It's the mu h. Okay. So when you plug the results of the exact perturbation theory, first order perturbation theory inside there, you find this. So you find the sum over all the eigenstates but the ground state. And then you have psi 0 of lambda, the mu h, psi n of lambda, so this is an excited state, psi n of lambda, the nu h, psi 0 of lambda. And then, as you can imagine, here you have the gap that is En to the lambda minus the ground state energy 0 to the lambda square. So everything can be expressed by just knowing the eigenstates, so we don't have the derivatives of the eigenstates anymore. And we just have the derivatives of the Hamiltonian. So here we notice, and we here have the gap square. So the gap and 0. Okay. So imagine now that we consider the first excited state. So it's the minimum of these gaps. So now you can see that when that if for some reason this goes to 0, this object could become singular, right? I mean, you know, things could, something could happen up here such it doesn't become singular, but we strongly suspect that it would become singular. So the message of this lecture is that we would like to show that when there is a quantum phase transition, so when there is, when D10 is going to 0 in the thermodynamic limit, so when the size of the system is going to infinity, then we have some singularity in Q mu nu. Okay, so I will first show it in two examples, and then I will give you a general proof that this is true. Okay, so the system that we study, so have you already done the tutorial about the XY model? Yes?
XY model?
Yeah.
In one dimension or?
Yes.
Yes, I did.
Okay. So, example. The XY spin chain, which is a generalization of our Ising model. So we have an Hamiltonian that depends on two parameters that I will call lambda and gamma. So this is what would be lambda 1, lambda 2. So I have a spin chain that contains L equal to m plus 1 spins. And I will write it in this way. Minus m, 1 plus gamma over 2. Sigma xi plus 1 plus 1 minus gamma 2 sigma yi plus 1 plus lambda sigma zi. Okay? So the first thing that we would like to see is what is the phase diagram of this model. So the phase diagram is gamma lambda. So first of all, you see that when gamma is equal 0, sorry, when gamma is equal 1, then this term is absent. And we just have the quantumizing model. So for gamma equal 1, we have the quantumizing model. So for gamma equal 1. And we know that we have a quantum phase transition for lambda equal plus 1. And actually also for lambda equal minus 1. So this plus 1, this minus 1. So these are the Ising critical points. But we have also two other critical lines that are, so actually these points extend to every value of gamma. So this is called the XX region of criticality for some reason. So it means that on these lines, the system becomes gapless. And then we have the gamma, so lambda equal plus minus 1 are called XX criticality regions. Criticality. then there is another interesting line that is gamma equals zero. So for gamma equals zero and the lambda smaller than one, so it is this part of the space diagram, this is called XY criticality region. Okay, so this is our phase diagram. And I would like to also add one more coordinate to this Hamiltonian. So I would like to have an Hamiltonian that is function of three parameters, lambda, gamma, phi, by rotating my Hamiltonian around the z-axis. Okay? So if I rotate my Hamiltonian around the z-axis, how do I do that? I have to define this rotation operator g of phi that is just the product on every spin. So from minus m to the m, I rotate about z, this is sigma, for some angle phi. So this becomes g phi my original h that only contains lambda and gamma, g dagger. So now you notice that if I introduce this new parameter, you know, these new operators in my Hamiltonian, they break my original Z2 symmetry because they contain sigma Z. And therefore, what can happen is that I can actually move from one point here to another point here without encountering a phase transition, because I can actually go around it. So I have another coordinate that is phi, and I can move it around without encountering a phase transition. So why I define this? Because I want to move around some critical line really without encountering a phase transition. Why I want to do that is because I would like to move around on this path adiabatically. And so you know that the adiabatic theorem fails if the gap goes to zero. So to do the adiabatic theorem, I need to avoid the phase transitions. But then I can compute the Berry phase associated to this. And I will show some consequences of it. Okay, so as you have done in the tutorial, you know that, so you can diagonalize this Hamiltonian with the same steps that are the Jordan-Wigner transformation, then the Fourier transform, and then the Bogoliubov transformation, and then land in something that is and so actually there is no phi dependence in this. So you know this rotation is just changing the eigenstates, but not the spectrum. So these energies are the same done before, so let me write them down. So lambda k is equal square root of epsilon squared k plus gamma squared sin squared 2 pi k over n, and where epsilon k is equal to cosine 2 pi k over n minus lambda. Then if I define the cosine of theta k over 2 like this ratio, then I can write these operators here are related to the original fermions in K space by the Bogoliubov transformation that reads. And here we have all that there is about the dependence on phi. So for phi equals 0, you have the familiar expression. And so it is interesting to write the ground state in function as a function of the vacuum of these operators. So after manipulating our expression a bit, you can write this ground state in this way. So we have cosine theta k over 2, 0 k, 0 k minus 1. So this is the vacuum of this operator, plus I e to the 2 I phi sin theta k over 2, 1 k, 1 minus k. And this is simply what you obtain if you act with the C dagger K or C dagger minus K onto this state. So this is the ground state of this Hamiltonian, but expressed as a vacuum of the other of the original Hamiltonian. This is a convenient expression because then I can I have some explicit form in terms of our parameter, because our theta k contain explicitly to this expression, they contain lambda and gamma. Okay, so we are interested in studying.
Excuse me, one small index is 0 k, k minus first.
So we are interested.
Question.
Yeah.
Don't we have anything with k equals 0 in this problem?
So yeah, so k, yeah, that's, so I am using k equal 1 up to n in this. These are my wavelengths.
Why not from 0?
I guess this happens because I've written it in this way instead of from 0 to l. So if you, and L is 2n plus 1.
Counting minus k's, we have 2n there. And in, when you do Fourier transform finite, you should have the same number between the two.
Yeah, so there's the same number, but I am. So the way k runs, so it depends somehow on the boundary conditions. Maybe this is the, maybe here I'm using periodic boundary conditions. Anyway, it's not very important. It's, you would find the same results. No, really, no matter what happens. Okay. So I will be interested in what happens when we get close to gamma equals 0. Okay? So I will do loops around this line, but then I will make smaller and smaller loops as I approach gamma equals 0. And so let me just show you that, yeah, indeed, at gamma equals 0, there is something going on. Because, so for gamma equals 0, then our lambda k, that are our excitations, well, are just the absolute value of epsilon k. So it's just equal to the absolute value of this. And so now you see that for the finite system, this number can never be zero. Anyway, if n is very, very, very large, I can get arbitrarily close. I can solve for k in order to get arbitrarily close to lambda, in order for this term to be arbitrarily close to lambda, and have epsilon k equal to zero. So this is another way of saying that, you know, the transition only happens in the thermodynamic limit. But for every m finite, if I compute the cosine of theta k, well, so the cosine of theta k will be just equal to epsilon k, cosine of theta k over 2, over lambda, over its absolute value. So just it's a sign. It can be plus 1 or minus 1. So why this is important? Because now I want to compute the Berry phase, right? So I want to compute the Berry phase as a function of the number of spins. Well, so if you work out the calculation, so what is the Berry phase? I have to integrate, take my ground state, then differentiate with respect phi, the ground state, and do this integral. Mm-hmm. Pretty much because you obtain the Berry phase by integrating that connection. Yes, so we have 2m plus 1 particles, so that our chain is going from minus m to m. Okay, so if you do this differentiation, well, and because our state is the product of m different states, just a second. What you obtain is that you obtain the sum of m Berry phases of this type. And actually, so since the beginning, I made a mistake. This is the definition. Here there is cosine theta 2, but this is the definition. So here is this. So what's the question?
No, I was completely interesting because then the sign was zero.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so this is just the sum of all these angles. Well, now you see that when I send gamma equal to zero, so the cosine is either plus 1 or minus 1. So here we get, for each of these things, we get either 0 or 2 pi, which is a trivial Berry phase. So we get the total Berry phase is either 2 pi m or 0, which is trivial. But now look what happens if I first take the thermodynamic limit. If I first take the thermodynamic limit, then I can find an x0. So be x0 be cosine 2 pi k over n. So that large n there is actually either m or l. I don't remember. But so let me write m. So it doesn't matter because the thermodynamic limit is the same. So I can find the solution for this equation. So if I find the solution for that equation, this means that, sorry, this equation. Well, but then in this case, we get, okay, that cosine of x0 is equal lambda. And therefore, when I do my limit for gamma going to 0 of my pi 1 minus lambda, so for some reason it switched. Okay, so this will give me, and then I can choose lambda equals 0 if I want. So for lambda equals 0, I will get pi. Or in general, I get a number that is different. So if I compute the average Berry phase, that is the limit for in the thermodynamic limit of 1 over m phi m, you find something different from 0, which is not 2 pi. So for lambda equals 0, in particular, is pi. So what is the meaning of all of this? The meaning is this. The Berry phase is usually proportional to the surface included in the loop. This is when there is no singularity. So as we shrink our loop, we expect this thing of going to 0. And if there is no quantum phase transition and everything is smooth, it goes to 0 or to pi, that is a trivial Berry phase. But if there is a critical line, which happens in the thermodynamic limit, instead, when you shrink the loop to 0, you find the residual adiabatic curvature, that is pi, which is given by the singularity that we have in that line. So we've shown in this example that the imaginary part, the Berry curvature, is singular at the critical point. And now we would like to, but I don't have the time to do it today. So tomorrow we will look at these other critical lines, the ones for lambda equal plus 1, lambda equal minus 1, and we will compute explicitly what are the components of G mu nu. And what we expect is that when gamma goes to plus 1, for instance, sorry, when lambda goes to plus 1, then we find a singularity, or when gamma is equal to 0 also. We find the singularity this, and we will also compute the Ricci tensor and the Ricci curvature from here, and we will see that they all show some singularities in this model when we approach the quantum phase transition.
Hey, what are the different interpretations? I mean, G mu nu, it will be like you get a metric, so it may have some sense that the space gets curved in the singularity, or you can imagine that the space gets curved, right? But
So you have associated a Riemannian metric to your manifold of ground states that are given by some Hamiltonian depends on parameters. So now, the points in which you have a phase transition, are the points in which the associated curvature that is induced by this matrix becomes singular. And quantitatively, it also means that even when it is smooth, those are points in which distances are growing faster. So if you use this curvature as a measure of how sensitive is your ground state as you change the parameters, so this is very important in applications because sometimes you want to drag your state in the ground state manifold by keeping it on your ground state manifold. So you don't want it to jump to some excited state. So you have to do it adiabatically. So you have to do it slow enough. So how slow is this slow enough is dictated by how much you are changing the state in the unit of time, which is dictated by this curvature. In fact, you can give a differential geometric treatment about, so imagine that I ask myself, okay, now I am in the Hilbert space, and now you can imagine all curved. And I want to move from one point to the other point. Well, I can do it in different paths, right? And then you ask yourself, what is the fastest path? So what is the brachistochrone in the Hilbert space? So this is very important in applications. Well, then what you have to do is that you have to find a geodesics on this space, and that so it becomes a variational problem that you can actually solve. So there are examples of applications in which this can be used. Other questions?